accession number 18463, reel 21.
Don Barrett, reel 21.
Anyway, the company kind of wasn't too pleased with the sheeting up there, but we couldn't do any more. We needed a ladder or something in order to get up there. And thing was, at that moment, we'd also got an instruction from presumably from brigade or maybe the brigade, the battalion commander, I don't know, that every platoon would dig a four-man post which would be roofed. So I set to on our LMG post, and we had this terrible thing of, well, we were not so bad now because we could undermine the stuff, and we dug it out and got it enough sufficient for four men to get in it. And we found all the lumber to roof it in, and obviously to dig a set of steps at the back. And we'd done the main digging, got down, took us about 4 or 5 hours, I guess, to get down. And this was about midnight now. And I got two of the chaps. I said to them, right, well, you haven't done any work. They've been on sentry and what have you. You haven't done any work. You roof it over, a simple enough job. And we'll go off and, you know, and have a bit of a rest and a meal. We went back to the hills. And they called us after about an hour and a half, something like that. So we've done it. You'll be pleased with it. So we went up. Yeah, we definitely were pleased. They'd roofed it in. You know, it was a space all the way around and you could shoot out of it. And they got it roofed in, and we all looked at them and said together, how do you get in? They'd forgotten how to get in. They'd roofed in the wretched trench, and we couldn't get in. So there was a bit of a giggle about that, and we left them again then to dig some steps or a route in, you know, to get into one end of the trench. That's quite amusing. And that night, there was a rather amusing incident. We had a paddy. I only know him as Paddy. I can't remember his name. I can't remember his name. It could have been Gary. It could have been anybody. He was a real Irish fella, and he'd been in the called up in the Second War, and his tale was he had been captured. He'd been in probably the only bayonet charge in France in 1940. He said they all lined up in the trenches, which is First World War stuff, fixed bayonets over the top, and of course naturally got shot down, he got wounded and captured and what have you. And now he was a reservist and sent out to us. But he was quite a good character. He wasn't in our platoon, he was in number 5 platoon. And our chaps, Biggie and Charlie Meyer, knew him well. And that night, apparently what's happening was he was on guard on the corner of the houses. The sentries, this is the platoon that's dug in under the houses. So their sentries at night are outside. They've got to be, because they've got to have a good view all the way around. And he heard something pushing or rubbing along the front of the house. And him and his pal cut their weapons and are there waiting for it. And they think it's a Chinese patrol, and their clothing is brushing against the side of the house. And they're obviously going to step out. And when he steps out, it's a damn great cow. And poor old Paddy let out a bit of a yell and dropped his weapon and jumped back. And we heard this story the following morning when he came to tell his pals. And the cow, of course, incidentally, unfortunately, we murdered its calf, I'm afraid, the day before, or the cooks had. And that, again, was another thing. They got this wretched calf. Decided that they cook it up for a good hot stew. Nobody knows how to cook it. Cooks won't kill it. Nobody's prepared to kill it. Even the butcher won't kill it. And poor old Jimmy Wilde had to shoot it with a pistol. And it was the toughest bit of meat I've ever tasted in all my life. I mean, most of it, you just couldn't eat it. It was a good stew, but the meat was absolutely stuffed. I guess poor old mum had come to find out what we'd done with her calf. Anyway, she scurries off and we don't ever see her again. And Paddy has his story to tell to his friends. Shortly after that, the platoon commander comes and says, tells me that he's sending off one of his platoon HQ sick. And he didn't tell me why, but I talked to the chap and he said, I've got appendicitis, I'm being sent off back to with an appendicitis, suspected appendicitis. And I said to the particular guy, probably the next day, I can't remember, he's got appendicitis. He said, no, he hasn't, he's got VD. He caught it in Hong Kong before we came, and now it had come out in the open. And he was sent off again, so we never saw him again. We're getting a bit thin on the ground again now, because a few reinforcements are not filling our ranks up again. In fact, we're getting very thin on the ground, and lots of people are going sick. Poor old Jack Oates, he went out on a patrol, and when he came back, his poor old head was down, and he's dragging his feet, he's got pneumonia. People are going down, falling all over the place with pneumonia, and everybody's got colds, of course, you know, and flu-like colds, and I'm not feeling very good myself, and I think I've got the flu. And our casualties are now going off to the Indian Field Ambulance, who joined us at Christmas, and they are a marvellous crew. They're airborne, and they either wear berets or maroon turbans, very, very smart, and very, very good in all that they do. In fact, it was said that the brigade commander, if he wanted anybody, he had a visitor and he wanted them to see how British soldiers should really look, he'd take them down there and they'd have a look at them, because I'm afraid we were literally in rags at this time. We'd also had an issue, I think it must have been in January, of balaclava helmets with just a slit for the eyes, which were first class, but unfortunately, of course, if you pull it up over your mouth or your nose, then it freezes solid and you've got a block of ice over your nose and your mouth. So they were good, but you didn't have, well, we did do it, I think, pull it up over the mouth and nose occasionally and suffered the ice-covered wool. But I think it was very, very cold, indescribably cold, and we are, as I said before, falling by the wayside with sickness. We've also, at this time, we've got 16th New Zealand Field arrived. I'd guess it was about 20th of January or something like that when they arrived, and it was said that they arrived late and said that they'd run up a couple of guns and fire over open sites overnight, and that was something that we were well pleased with, because that hadn't been the policy of anybody prior to them arriving. And they then had to fire in the guns, and we stood to, and in the trenches, that is, and we presumed they were going to fire about 500 yards ahead of us, and there was a little track junction, and there had been no civilians across this track junction at all up until this time. And we're standing to in the trenches, and the platoon commander called out and said, they're firing, and we were straining our eyes to see where they'd landed. Just at that moment, elderly lady with an A-frame on her back, loaded up A-frame, starts trudging across her front. And we literally held our breath. I mean, we just couldn't believe that she happened to turn up at that moment. And I think by this time the shells must have been in flight, because it was no way of stopping it. And they landed exactly on the track junction in the paddy fields all round. And there was this great columns of snow and mud, frozen clods and what have you. And well, we expected not to see her when it cleared, and to our absolute amazement, it cleared and she's still walking on as if nothing had happened at all. We could not believe it, but she literally was in the middle of the salvo, which was basically either bursting on the path where she was standing, or in the paddy, which would be about 3 or 4 feet low, and it didn't touch her at all. If it did, I mean, I can't believe that she didn't have little bits on her, of shrapnel in her, you know, fragments on her. But she just walked gaily on wherever she was going. And shortly after she'd left, she moved on, another salvo came on. But they say they were very close to us. And I heard later from a New Zealander, the problem was in Korea that the cold, you know, extreme colds, because it was like it ranged between 20 and 40 below at various times at night, the wind blowing 40, and during the day probably 20, and never above zero. It apparently shortens the range by anything up to 500 to 600 yards. So I would guess that was the problem here, that they didn't really intend firing on this track junction, which is quite close to us, perhaps 200 yards ahead. But everything foreshortened. And we heard later that, in fact, they dropped their first salvo in the midst of, funny enough, number 6 platoon B company of the Argyles, and had to send a bottle of whiskey up to placate them. But they were grand lads. I mean, this is just one of those things that happens. We were quite used to this by this time, because the artillery very rarely fired without firing one into us. Their first shots would nearly always come into us. And things settled down then. Prior to this, we'd had trials to see how we withdraw from the position, because at this time in Korea, the policy was that, the overall policy was that we thought that we were going back the Busan perimeter and that we would be withdrawn to Japan. And in fact, although we were obviously never aware of this, it wasn't until, I think it was just about the time MacArthur got the sack, that the decision was made to stay in Korea, the final decision was made to stay in Korea, remain in Korea. And we went, did this trial run, which meant virtually we went back the way that we'd actually advanced into the position. Then there was a long, long march, you know, of miles to where the transport would be, assuming, of course, that the enemy were not in close contact at that time. But we were at the end of the column, and we got stopped on this narrow path. And after about an hour, nothing happening. Presumably all the officers had gone forward, you know, to discuss the route and what have you. And chap, I'll call him Black Boris. That was what we called him, because at Christmas we'd had a Blackfeet competition. And the reason for this was nobody had had a bath or wash or what have you for what, since September. Well, except me, of course. I'd had my bath on the 5th of November. But everybody else was black, so I had no hope of winning this competition. But the idea was, on a particular time, on a particular day, we'd whip off our socks, flash our feet, and the winner would have the blackest, dirtiest feet of all. Unfortunately, of course, along came Black Boris one day. He'd nipped in from his hut over to us, and he dressed in, I must point out, in Long John's comms, not Long John's comms, with his boots on. And we told him about our Blackfeet competition, and he whipped off his boots and socks, and he had the blackest feet I'd ever seen. So although he wasn't our platoon, we said, well, there's no contest, you're the winner. From then on, he was always known as Black Boris, and a very good chap, that's a fact. That he came up anyway from behind and said, well, I'm bored with this, he said. So he got his sten and started practicing with his sten in a tree. And I must say, we all held our breath, because we expected somebody, you know, CSM or somebody, to come running back. But nobody came back, so I guess they were a mile or two ahead doing things. And all we did then was turn around and go back again. We hadn't gone more than half a mile, but presumably the point knew where they were going. And shortly after this, after the withdrawal plans and the artillery fire, word came from brigade that they were very concerned that 6th Rock Division, who was forward of us and on our left-hand side, I didn't know this at the time, but in fact they were, I thought we were facing north actually at that moment in time, and they were to the west, but in fact we were facing west. But this is the sort of thing that happens to the soldiers. Even myself, who had a compass, I never bothered to use it to find out where we were, because I'm getting a bit dull at this time. In fact, my flu's getting pretty grim. In fact, it's very grim. And I'm selected to take a patrol out the following morning to make contact with the rocks. And I've got to go to the rocks, command post, and then find out where their positions are, and then make a great sweep round and come back in from a completely different direction. That's normal patrol stuff. You go out and you never come back on the same route. Unfortunately, in Korea, quite often you had to, because there wasn't any other route. But that's always a bit difficult, because you know, they could be laying in wait for you along the return route. Anyway, the following morning, it's thick fog, very thick fog, and I'll be honest, I thought the patrol would be cancelled, but you obviously can't cancel the trolls. John Swarbrick came over and said, well, take a bearing with the compass and then take a back bearing and you'll be able to find your way back with that without any trouble, which is okay. And my brain's gone dull. I can't think, first of all, I can't think how to do the back bearing. And when I do it, I haven't got anything to write it on, and I try to remember it, and cut a long story short, I don't think I did it. I certainly didn't write it down. Anyway, we formed up just in front of the village, and John came out and gave us their orders, or company commander came out and gave us their orders, and ordered me to, when we got out to the limit of the fog, which at this time had lifted just a little bit and was about, I would guess, 200 yards ahead of us, although we had to go by a devious route to get to this 200 yards. And he said, look back when you get on the fog and see if you can see our positions and see how they stand out. And in particular, that massive great granite thing that you've supposedly camouflaged with white sheets, which we had to the best of our ability. The wind had blown them off a little bit. Anyway, we're standing there. First thing with any patrol, I suppose it's nervousness, I don't really know why, but everybody has to have a pee. So you, at this time, when you peed on the ground, it froze instantly in a puddle, a rippled puddle about as big as a dinner plate. No, absolutely instantly it froze, and I remember having my wee and watching the puddle there. And then we set off. Obviously, I've got, I've probably only got about six men at this time, because we're pretty low on the ground, myself and about six men. And we go across the front, find a track, and head into the fog. Stop at the edge of the fog, look back, and, well, there was, you could pick out all of our positions because there were tracks in the snow leading to them. The sheets had blown off of our pillar. And the only people you couldn't see, and that were completely covered, were those who dug in under the houses, dug, you know, lifted the floor, dug in underneath them, and there was no sign whatsoever of them. But there were tracks leading up the hill to where Forbiton was, and ours wasn't much better. Anyway, we went off into the fog then. I'm leading, and it became extremely dense now. Very, very dense. Went on, I can't really tell you how far we went on, but I looked to the right, and there were civilians, I hope they were civilians anyway, on a track to my right, heading towards their positions. I'm sure they were civilians. Went on about another distance, 300 or 400 yards. It's very, you can't tell in the fog, it's absolutely impossible to tell how far you're going. And suddenly we came to a window in the fog, for want of a better word. And looking to my left, I stepped into it and stepped back again quickly and stopped everybody. Looking to my left, there was a chap who looked like a Chinese. You can't tell who they were. Behind a 30 caliber MG, standing up there with his hand on the trigger. And I did think he was Chinese. He looked Chinese in the padded uniform bit. So I said to the lads, well, he can't see us. I don't think he's seen us at the moment. We'll walk across and we'll wave to him as we walk across. And that's what we did. It was only about 10 yards gap in the fog, I guess. And as we went across, we waved to him and he waved back. But we were a little bit nervous now because it might well be a Chinese up on this gun. It could also be a rock because they dress very similar. It went on, I don't know, another 500 yards maybe. And suddenly the fog lifted. And there ahead of us, I couldn't believe it, there was a road junction. Houses on the right of what we presume was now the road. You couldn't see because the fog, the snow was so thick that you couldn't pick out roads or rivers or anything like that. It was just snow-covered ground. But there was smoke coming up from one of the houses. And also, a woman was standing at the door looking in our direction. And I got the glasses out and had a quick look. And I couldn't believe it. At this road junction, there's an MP, who I think must be a rock, with his white helmet and his lanyard and his white belt and all the rest of it. There wasn't any traffic, actual fact, but I mean, he was there directing traffic. And suddenly a Jeep went across and he went through the motions of, you know, as if it was a very busy London street to get him across. So we guess now that this must be six rocks that we'd actually stumbled into. So we went on up to him, We had an interpreter, incidentally, with us. And he went up to the MP, who was a bit sullen, to be quite honest. And he wasn't very helpful, but we got him to ask where the Rock Command Post was, and he pointed to a house just down the road, 200 yards or something like that. And we moved off to this house and introduced ourselves to a chap. But I mean, I don't know what these guys were, but they didn't seem to be senior Rock officers. They were, because I would say, more like bandits. And they had what they said were nurses in there with them, which didn't look very much like nurses to us. And they were very sort of chatty to the interpreter, and one of them could speak a little bit of English. Brought us out a great hunk of meat, must have been a foot square, I should think. Solid, you know, solid frozen meat. Gave to us, and gave to me, in actual fact. I didn't know what the hell to do with it, and I gave it to one of the lads, and he wraps it in his towel and put it in his pack. And they were chatting there, and of course, naturally, the lads are chatting up the so-called nurses. And one of the lads, most of us have got frostbitten fingers, you know, cracks and lips and ears and all the rest of it. And one of the lads said, pointed to them and said, "What do you, you know, have you got anything you could do from, you know, as a nurse for my frostbitten fingers?" She went over to the wall and tore a piece of paper off the wall and wrapped it around his fingers. So we probably thought that they didn't have too much nursing capacity amongst them. Anyway, I told them the way we were going to go out and sweep on down through their sector and across these fields and back to her. And he said, no way, you can't go that way. It's absolutely blocked, filled with snow. Must go back the way you came. So I said, well, we can't go back the way we came because, you know, our orders are very strict. We can't ever do that. So we compromised and decided to go down a track which... He now pointed out to us the machine gunner was in fact one of theirs. They had one lone man on a 30 caliber machine. It's unbelievable, really, protecting them, their flank. And we trundled off down here. I guess we went about 400 yards, and then we saw this, following this track, where one man had walked down. Then we saw him and gave him a wave and went on. But the snow is getting so thick now. The fog's cleared a little bit. You could see about 100 yards, I guess. But the snow, which is like powder, it's not like snow in England, it's like face powder is about the best way to describe it. You couldn't make a snowball with it or anything like that. And we're literally floundering through it. And we eventually, I guess, we're probably halfway back, I guess. And it's now up to our waist. And the lads are pretty shattered by this. Well, I'm shattered as well. We're all shattered by this time. And I said to them, well, we'll stop here for a moment. And I'll see if I could find a way, a clearer way, because it's getting thicker. It must be 8 foot high ahead of us. And at the moment I said this, they all flopped down, literally vanished into this powdery snow. There wasn't a sign except a hole where they'd gone. Started to clamber up the slope. And one of the other chaps, Wardy, he said, I'll come with you. And we eventually got to the top of this ridge. And there were little bushes up there, and the wind had blown the snow off the top of the ridge, so it was only about a foot or something thick up there. And we laid there and got our breath back. And looking down, it looked as if, knowing where the machine gunner had been, that the track that we came out on, which we shouldn't have used, was probably about 100 yards, 200 yards ahead of us. So we called the lads up, and they were... We eventually got them up out of their snow holes, or another better word, and they literally, the only way was to swim through it. That's the only description I can, way of describing how you could get through it. If you made swimming motions, you actually could get through this snow, and they eventually came to the top and collapsed amongst the bushes and puffing and panting and what have you. Gave them a couple of minutes rest, but we were desperate to push on because we were well behind schedule by this time. I've not got my compass out. I don't know why. I just couldn't think. Couldn't seem to think straight, actually, at this moment of time. We go straight out, we're leading. I had Wardy up with me. We eventually find the track. It's a 99% chance that it's the right track. So we turn right onto it. And I now let Wardy go at the front, and I stay at the rear just to keep things sort of... everybody moving, because I didn't think some of them would I thought they might collapse, in actual fact. Anyway, we push on, and Wardy stops and calls me forward, because as we've been coming back down the track, just about when we got to the machine gunner, we heard some shell fire, and we couldn't quite make that out. I mean, it had to be ours, but we couldn't think why, with a patrol out, shells were dropping on the other side of the ridge. And there, on the track, they'd fired a salvo, and it was 16 field, and it was absolutely straddled the track, and because there are no shell craters in war these days. I mean, there's only just a black mark on the snow, and I suppose a crater about as big as a dinner plate. And we realised then that had we been a few minutes earlier, we'd obviously been on the track and in the fire. It wasn't their fault, of course, because we shouldn't have been on this track. We shouldn't have been going back the way we came. Went on then to the edge of the fog. So I stopped them on the edge of the fog, and we looked out, and we could see no one was looking our way. So I suppose in a sense we're feeling a bit guilty. I'm feeling a bit guilty now because we've come back on this track. And I stayed in the fog and went over to our right flank, which would like be the left flank of the platoon position, where there was a big village. Went into this village and then came out of the fog then. And the village, it's unusual actually, it was laid in a great hollow, this village, and there were one or two people in it in various places. And of course we decided to search the village, and well, I must have be honest, we were looking for things like anything to eat, be quite honest, because everybody was starving, hungry, although the people of course were far worse than we were. And I found a young lady who was cooking up something, and I just said to her, "Ego, ego," and she sort of shook her spoon at me and I left. But the lads, in the meantime, have found a chicken, very scrawny chicken. And they look elderly, but they probably were in their 30s or 40s, civilians. And they're messing about with this chicken, trying to catch it, which gets up on the roof of the house, and they persuade the chap living in the house to get a ladder. And he obviously he hasn't got a clue on a ladder. He's frightened he's going to fall off. And instead of getting up and catch it, they, of course, naturally, he doesn't want us to have his chicken, so he just shoots it off. And we must have been, it was hilarious. I mean, people were rolling about with laughter. I mean, I'm sure if the Chinese had been there, they'd have been laughing as well with his chicken. But then eventually I said, "Well, come on, let him have his chicken." And we cleared off and went back to the platoon and reported in. Told them about the shellfire, but they didn't seem to know much about it. I'm not really sure why they didn't, or anything, you know, about it, and told them it was quite impossible to come back on the around the route that they'd given me to come. But I said to the platoon commander and the company commander later, when I went with him to see him, that this village, which we hadn't known was there until then, was a very good forming up place, and it was a bit of an area that should be looked at fairly regularly. And naturally, of course, decision was made that we should look at it that night at midnight, and that's exactly what we did do. We about midnight we went out. It all seems worse at night, of course, always patrols. We eventually went out and got to the village, which was black and very forbidding, and went down into about the middle of it, and decided discretion was a better part of valour, and it wasn't much point going in the houses. And there was no sound, no fires, no nothing there. Came back. We had to come back with the same route, because that is the only route that we can see into this village, and reported that there was no one there. And I don't know really now what happened. I must have done a turn of stag. I think I probably did. I can sort of vaguely remember lying over the parapet of the trench, and just one of the trenches, and with somebody. But I can't remember very much about it at all. And the next morning at stand two, I must have stood two. But my next memory really is being sitting propped up in our